Tonight we're going to continue on with life-giving relationships, okay? And so we've been talking about four different levels of life-giving relationships, four ingredients in having a life-giving relationship, and tonight we're going to go into a fifth. Now, when we talk about life-giving relationships, it enters into our marriages, it enters into our friendships, enters into our community, enters into every aspect of life. Matter of fact, the most important thing to God is relationship. You know, when you look at, there's some parables. Sinners and tax collectors like to hang out with Jesus because Jesus was a giver of life. So they didn't have everything together correctly. But when they were around Jesus, they felt better.
Come on.
Because he was a giver of life. And Jesus, when he was confronted by some religious people of why that was, why would he hang out with sinners and tax collectors? He answered them with four parables. And I've said these before, and I didn't plan on starting with this tonight, but I feel led by the Spirit to just share this. Because when we're talking about relationships, all relationships begin in God. And then we got to know what's the purpose of relationships. How important is it? When Jesus was confronted by those Pharisees I believe it's Luke chapter 15, about why sinners and tax collectors hung around him, he said, he gave four parables, three in Luke chapter 15 and one in Luke chapter 16. And he said, well, the first parable is, if you had 100 sheep, one wandered off, which of you wouldn't go after that one sheep that's missing? And then when you found that sheep, you would leave 99 in the wilderness to find the one sheep that's lost. And then when you find that sheep, you'd call your neighbors and you'd throw a party. And you'd say, I found the sheep that was lost. And simply, that's the question in the heart of every human being concerning who is God. He's the one who cares for all people. So first and foremost, we were not born to be right. We were born to be loved. We've already talked about that in life-giving relationships. My relationship with God, your relationship with God, doesn't start because you had it together. It started because he loved us. He cares for us. He would leave the 99 in the wilderness to find the one sheep that's lost. Call his neighbors and throw a party and say, I found you. Because he cares for people. He loves people. And then he told a second parable, and the second parable was about a lady that had silver coins. She had 10 silver coins, and she lost one. And she gets down with a broom and a light. She starts sweeping the floor everywhere to find that silver coin. And when she finds the coin, she calls her neighbors, throws a party, says, I found the coin that was lost, the silver coin. And I think that second parable talks about people who are we. The first question is, who is God? He's the one who cares for all people. The second question is, who are we? Every human being is an expression of him. And the price that was paid for every human being is the only begotten Son of God. So the price for every human being is one and only. So everybody has exactly the same value. All of the 10 silver coins, 10 is a judgment of love. All of the 10 coins had exactly the same value. And so I believe the woman was like the Holy Spirit. Gets down on his knees, her knees, his knees. Sweeps the floor with a light and looks for that lost coin. And when that coin is found, when you are found, he calls the neighbors and throws a party and says, found him. See, you're one and only. You're an expression of God. That's relational. It doesn't have to do with anything of what great thing I'm going to do or what great success I'm going to make. It's I'm an expression of God. You know, if I understand that, that helps me understand my relationship with God and my relationship with my wife or my relationship with my kids or my grandkids or my friends or my community. Every human being is one and only. They're an expression of God. And then he tells a third parable, which is often called the parable of the lost of the prodigal son. But it's not about a prodigal son. It's about a family. It's about a dad and two sons and a family business. And when a youngest son gets to the age of inheritance, he asks for his portion, and his father gives him his portion of inheritance, and he leaves, and then he spends it, he squanders it, he wastes it on prodigal living, wasteful living. And he gets desperate because he runs out of money. He ends up having to get a job. And of course, he's a Jewish guy, and he ends up feeding pigs. And so he ends up doing the most humiliating thing he could do in his culture or in his family. And then he thinks, my goodness, if I just had a job for my dad, it would be better than this. I don't deserve to be his son. I just want to go home and get a job. And so every day now, the father, he's been on the edge of the road every day. And he's been waiting for his son to return. He's not gone after him and chased him down. See, relationship doesn't go after you and chase you down. Because true love doesn't chase you down. True love believes in you and believes that you'll get a revelation of where home is. But then the father at home, he doesn't stay in the house. He's on the edge of the road. He has an expectation of the one who lost his senses. He has an expectation that he's going to come to his senses. He doesn't expect him to stay deceived. He expects him to come to his senses. When's he going to come to his senses? When's he going to come home? When's he going to come home? And then when he sees him afar off, he runs out and he grabs his son and he kisses him. Now, he doesn't. In the story, the father doesn't know what the son has done. He doesn't know if the son is married. He doesn't know if the son has children, if the son is a successful businessman, an entrepreneur. He doesn't know if he's gay. He doesn't know if he's straight. He doesn't care. He didn't care.
Come on.
He just knows my son left home, and this is a family business. And then he sees the son. He runs and he kisses him. And then what does he do? He says, put my robe on him. He says to the servant, go get my robe, put it on him. Put my ring on him. Put my sandals on his feet. So he's saying, and by the way, go kill that cow, that fatted calf we've been saving up for the feast. This is the feast. This is the feast. Sometimes we get so religious, we get hung up on, well, is it the feast time? You know, the feast time is any time a child of God comes to their senses. It's feast time.
Come on.
So the father puts his testimony on the man. He puts his authority on his finger. And he puts his feet in his inheritance. The son has spent all of his portion of the inheritance. He's wasted his portion of the testimony. And he's messed up his portion of the authority. And he doesn't even have anything to eat anymore. And the father says, it's impossible for you to outwaste the testimony of our family. It's impossible for you to destroy the authority of our family. It's impossible for you to ruin the inheritance of our house. It's impossible for you to be in poverty with the abundance of our house. And son, you were always intended to be a part of the family business. We'll add rooms. So they throw a party. And then the older son, he hears it. He's wondering, what's going on? What's going on? So he goes to the servants, what's going on? Oh, haven't you heard? Haven't you heard? Your brother who was lost, your brother, he's come home. And he's killed the fatted calf. And now the older son is probably thinking, that the cow I've been feeding, you mean the one that I've been cleaning up its manure, that one, the one that I've been feeding, the one that we've been saving, the one that dad owns, but I've done all the work. Yeah, that one. And so then he's really upset. He's angry. And he goes to the father. And he said, Dad, I've done everything that you wanted. I've done everything you've expected. I've been to church every week. I've never missed tithing. I've brought offerings. I pray at prayer time. I've done everything that is expected in this place. And you've never done this for me. And the father said, son, you can have this any time. See, the father was saying, this is a family. And I don't need any of my sons to work for me. I don't need any of my sons or my daughters to serve me. I don't need any of my sons to go and leave home to try to prove themselves and become successful. What I need them to know is we live together in all things. We tabernacle. We live together in all things. See, I care for you. I give life. You're an expression of me. I give breath. And it's a family business. I give you all things. Now, I know I've told this here before. Some of you maybe never heard it before. And some of you heard it. And that was Charlie Brown the first time. So now you're hearing some words. But then there's a fourth story that ticks me off. And it's found in Luke 16 because there's a fourth parable. And I like to say the first three parables answer the question of all human hearts. Who is God? Who am I? And who is God and I together? They may not use those words, but they're saying, what is life? Where is life? Who is God? And who am I? That one's pretty easy. Almost everybody can articulate that. Who am I? Been asking that all day, all my life. I remember as a kid thinking that. Who am I? Who am I? And then the third question, when you figure out who God is and you figure out who you are, who are you together? But then there's a fourth question. What's the point? What's the point? And I think Luke 16 answers the question of what's the point. And the parable is this. There's a guy who has a job as a manager for a company. And he's not a good manager. And he's getting a pig slip. I'm putting this in modern words, but he's getting the pig slip. He's getting fired. And he hears about it. But he's been with the company a long time. And he's eating a little bit too much. And he's not exercised too much. And he's getting a bit old. His bones are a little creaky. And he thinks, what in the world am I going to do? A guy at my age is surely not going to find a job. So he thinks, I'm too old to get to work. I'm too old to do construction labor. And I'm too proud to beg. What am I going to do? And then he realizes, I'm still the manager. So he goes to somebody that owes his boss some goods. He says, what do you owe my master? And the guy says, well, 100 measures of oil. He said, make it 50. We'll call it good. And then he goes to another one. He said, what do you owe my master? What do you owe my boss? What do you owe my employer? 100 measures of wheat. Hey, make it 80. We'll call it good. Now, the master, the boss, the employer's watching this. And he's thinking, this guy is smart. Because he's making friends. He knows he's about to lose his job. And the only thing that's going to get him through in life is who loves him. So he just went to somebody that owes me 100 measures of oil and made a deal with them. And they paid it quickly. He made a deal with them so that when he doesn't have a job, they'll remember he did them that favor. And the same way with the wheat. And then Jesus in this parable, he says the people in the world are shrewder than the sons of the kingdom. And he says, if you're faithful with mammon, you'll be faithful with much. But in the story, it's not the man's money. He's dealing with the father's debts. He's dealing with the master's debts. He's making it so that the master doesn't get what's owed him. And that really bugged me. And this has everything to do with relationships. And God has the nerve in Jesus Christ here to say he's being faithful with mammon. And the Pharisees got ticked off at this story, and I can see why. I'm enough of a Pharisee, I got ticked off at it the first time I heard it. I mean, I've read it many times, but the first time I heard it. And the story is this. Not any one of us in this room can pay our debt. And the point is, God does not expect anyone to pay their debt. But he expects everyone to figure out what's the point. The point is friendship. The point is relationship. The man was making friends. Because it's the only thing that'll get you through in life. So the most important thing that I've discovered about God in 44 years of life is he's my friend.
Come on.
And I think I'm becoming his. And the most important thing I've discovered about my wife and I in 40 years of marriage is she's my friend. And I'm her friend. I've raised three children, and one is 37, one is 35, and one will be 30 in June. And you know what? The most important thing I've discovered about my kids, they're my best friends. And it makes it really cool. They love God, so they know God's their friend too, and it really makes it really wonderful in our relationship. Matter of fact, my grandkids, which are 9, 6, 4, and 2, they're my friends. And this is what they know about Grandpa. He's my friend. You know, I used to think I had to love people. But then I found out I don't have to love anybody. But I need a revelation of who they are. And then I'll discover they're my friends. I remember a time when I was part of a church and I heard God speak to me about going into ministry, and when I asked about going into ministry, I said, I feel God is calling me into ministry. My pastor told me, you don't have a fivefold gift, and it'll be a waste of time. It'll be a big mistake. And so I said, I don't need to have a fivefold gift. I just hear God saying to me that I'm supposed to pursue this. Maybe it's music. I don't know what it is. I'm willing to do anything. And so I started doing street ministry, and I was spending 40 hours on the street a week and 60 hours at my job. I mean, I was away from home 100 hours a week. And I was with a lot of people coming to Christ, and I was taking my pastor on the street with me. And finally, I really felt God was calling me to be a part of a ministry that was working full time in the street. And so I asked him if God was saying anything to him, and he said, no. And I said, well, God's speaking to me, and I'm really asking you to release me to pursue this. And so my pastor, who I've been with for 15 years, moved to 3 states with him. And I'd lived in Mississippi with him, moved to Texas with him, and then moved to Washington with him, was his worship leader for 15 years. And he said, well, he told me my ministry would be cut short and that there would be no blessing. And he told the church they couldn't talk to me, they couldn't wave at me, they couldn't have anything to do with me. So my kids were little, and I sat my kids down, and we lived on the same driveway. We had a 2.5-mile driveway that we shared with our pastor. And so I sat my kids down and I said, now, boys, you need to understand, our friends are confused. But they're our friends. And they're not going to talk to us. They're not going to wave at us. They think daddy's in sin, but he's not. So here's what we're going to do. We're Hansons. And we are not going to do that. When we see them, we're going to wave at them. We're going to talk to them. So I would pull the car over when my pastor, previous pastor, was driving up the road. I'd pull my car over tight enough he'd have to stop, and I'd roll the window down and start talking to him with my boys in the car. And I'd say, would you like breakfast this week? And I would talk to him. And this went on. And after a couple of years, that previous pastor was an associate with another ministry, and they had a Tuesday prayer meeting. Now, by this time, I was a pastor. And it was actually 3 years later, and I was actually pastoring a church. And they had a Tuesday prayer meeting for pastors, so I thought, I'm a pastor. So I went, and with my previous pastor was there, and I prayed every Tuesday, and we prayed in tongues, and we prayed for 1 year. And I was always friendly and always chose to be innocent to evil and wise to good. Okay. And at the end of that year, my previous pastor came to my office, asked for a meeting, and he walked into my office, sat down in the chair, and started to cry. And he said, I'm sorry. You were right. I was wrong. Would you forgive me? And I said, it's all right. You're my friend. Now, he went on and became a pastor up in Canada, retired in Canada. He's a Facebook friend today. His children, one of his sons was a member of my church. His grandkids were in my preschool. You know, sometimes our friends get confused.
Come on.
Sometimes in the relationship with God, we get confused.
Come on.
Sometimes in our relationships with our spouses, we get confused. Sometimes in family, we get confused. Now, I cannot change what someone else does. So when I point the finger, I've been saying this for several nights, whenever I point the finger, there are three fingers pointing back at me. So when I talk about life-giving relationships start with me. What am I going to be to people in my life? Am I only a friend to those who give me something? Or can I be a friend that gives when nothing is given? Because God is the author of friendship. God is the author of life-giving relationships. And He gave me life before I gave Him anything. And He didn't need me to give Him life to be good with Himself. When we crucified Jesus, it didn't change who He was. And so He still spoke words of love and life. So we've been talking about levels of relationship. And we've talked about some levels so far about commitment and actions, or actions of faith and responses and submission. And so I'm going to give you some phrases for that in case you weren't here, or in case you hadn't heard this and you're tuning in at this point. But the Holy Spirit is the author of relationships, and He wants us to have a relationship with God first that's empowered by grace, and it comes by a revelation of God's love for us, empowers us to have this grace of love for Him. And then that will affect our relationships in our families, our marriages, our friendships, our communities. It'll even affect our ability to be friends to people in the world. Because to be a friend, you don't need someone to be your friend to be a friend. If you get a revelation of life-giving relationships. Okay, so the first thing is commitments are motivated by something. Every commitment is motivated by something. And the only commitment that will not fail is a commitment that's motivated by love. So there has to be a revelation of love. Jesus died for me. He died for you because He loved me. He loved you. He loved the Father. He knew the Father loved you. The Father sent Jesus because He loved you. And everyone who has not yet said yes to Jesus, the Father loves them. No one is in trouble with God. Many people might be in trouble, but no one needs to be in trouble. No one is in trouble with God. if they let go of the trouble that they're in. So God hates wickedness and he hates unrighteousness because wickedness and unrighteousness suppresses the truth with a lie. But he doesn't hate wicked people and unrighteous people. He hates wickedness and unrighteousness that binds good and bad people to confusion. And the truth is suppressed. And what's the truth? He loves you. And when you get a revelation that God loves you, it will change your heart. It'll change your mind. And you'll say, here I am. Here I am. You picked me. That same revelation works in marriage. My marriage with my wife is based on a revelation. Our commitment is not based on vows we made on a wedding day. Our vows are not what hold us. Our love is what holds us. So we continually return to our first love. Hi, here I am. We don't return to our first experience. Because if we return to our first experience, it can't be a first experience. It's a second, a third, a thousandth, a 2,000th. Now it's old. I don't even care anymore. But if I say, here I am, I can enjoy growing old. If I say, here I am, I can enjoy hard days. I can enjoy good days. I can enjoy rainy days and sunny days. If I say, here I am, and she says, here I am, when two I ams come together, it's a greater I am. I happen to believe God is I am, and we're a whole lot of little I ams in him. And all of the little I ams reveal the greatness of the great I am. But all the do-dos and all the doings of the world can't even come close to express even one fraction of an I am to him. So the will of God is who I am, not what I do. And so who I am is more important than what I do. I'm not a husband, I'm Bonnie's husband. I'm not just a son, I'm Ted, God's son. And I'm motivated by love because he's motivated by love toward me. So that's the strength of my commitment. So then when the earthquakes, when he does something that doesn't, if what he is shakes me because who he is precious to me. If I don't know he's precious, I can't live without him, then what he is could shake me. How many of you have discovered that God does not, we don't get him. We don't think like him. You figure that out?
Yeah.
Have you ever watched him? Have you ever watched how he gives good words to bad people? I hate that. Have you ever watched how he gives good words to your enemies? Doesn't even know. Doesn't he know? I mean, he even lets my football team lose sometimes.
What team might that be?
What I'm trying to say is, his justice system is different than my justice system. My justice system is based on right and wrong, fair and unfair. And his justice system is a justice system of love. So when someone does something unthinkable, terrible and wrong, he looks at it through the eyes of love and says, still love you. We look at it, can't love you till you change. Change, and I'm here. I'm ready to love you. Change, I'm ready to love you. Change, I'll love you when you change. I'm here. Change, and I'll love you. God says, still love you. That's a terrible justice system. Isn't that a terrible justice system? I mean, it's not terrible when it's in my direction, but when it's in the direction of my enemies, what's with that? Doesn't he know those are my enemies? I mean, I'm his favorite. And those are my enemies he's loving. Even when he says, you know, pray for your enemies, it'll heat burning coals on their heads. Do you know that's a phrase that's relevant to the culture? It doesn't mean roast them, toast them. It's a way of carrying fire from village to village and a pot on top of your head. And he's saying, pray for your enemies, bless them, don't pray for them. It'll heap burning coals on the tops of their heads. Maybe they don't have any way to keep warm. Maybe they don't have any light. Maybe they can't cook their food. If you knew their story, if you had their life, you would act just like them maybe. Everybody has a story. And when somebody acts as your enemy, don't see them as their enemy. Just remember, they have a story. And don't stop being who you are. Friend is not what I do. Friend is what I am. Husband to my wife is not what I do. Bonnie's husband's what I am. I'm not a husband. I'm Bonnie's husband. Child of God is not what I do, it's what I am. Son of God is not what I do, it's what I am. Man of God is not what I do, it's what I am. Leader is not what I do, it's what I am. And so what I am needs to prove to be motivated by love. If I'm not motivated by love, the first earthquake, the first offense, I'm going to take offense. Okay? You're going to be offended. Remember I told you. Okay, this morning, I offended my fingernails. I grabbed my fingernail clippers and I clipped all of my fingernails this morning. And none of my fingers took offense. None of them took an offense. But I offended every one of them. Before I came here, I offended my hair. I went to the lady that cuts the hair and she got a sharp thing and cut all the hairs. All of them. She got all of them. Lucky me. So relationships begin with a revelation of love. So I think first of all and foremost in everything, whether it's with one another, with our friends, with our enemies, my enemy doesn't have to love me for me to love them. The world doesn't have to love me for me to love them. And it's different than loving the things of the world. Loving people in the world is good. Loving the things that give them identity is a mistake. Because we get our identity from the place of an I am, not a thing. Doesn't mean you don't enjoy stuff. Just enjoy stuff with friends. Everything in life. I think God gave us all kinds of taste buds so we could enjoy food with friends. I think God gave us all kinds of senses so we could enjoy life with friends. We could enjoy life with Him. The second thing was actions. Okay, and so our commitments lead to our actions. And so actions have to be also actions that are motivated by love. So motivations of love then inspire us to do actions of faith toward a person. Life-giving relationships are always faith toward a person, not faith toward a promise. Faith toward a person. So if my children make mistakes, I'm still going to have faith toward them as children. I believe in them. Now, God isn't going to make a mistake. But I don't know about you, but in 44 years of knowing God, I have had a few times where I have thought He's made a mistake. That was a mistake. It's a good thing I'm not God, because I would have done a whole lot of things different than Him, and it probably would have ended up really bad, because He's made a lot of mistakes, according to me. Okay, and if I am not careful, if I don't know He loves me when He does the things that I see as mistakes. Now, I didn't say He makes mistakes. I said I believe He makes mistakes. Okay, now, if you are telling me you don't believe He makes mistakes, you are lying.
Got me.
Okay. Because in reality, we put you in the right situation. I promise you believe He makes mistakes. And every pastor in town and every human on planet Earth believes God makes mistakes. And if you say, no, I don't. Well, that's a confession, but it's not truth. It may be becoming truth, and thank goodness you're confessing it. That's good. I'm being vulnerable and honest. That's all I'm doing. But here's the deal. My friend God still doesn't condemn me or shame me, even though I have that weakness. And so I got a revelation. He loves me. Now I'm going to begin to increasingly trust when he says something that I don't think is true. Like, you know, he tells Saul, go destroy the Amalek. The men, the women, the children, the cattle, everything. Destroy it all. Destroy it all. What do you think about that one? Okay, so he goes out and he makes some decisions. Well, this one's good, that one's not. And then he goes back and he says, hey, we did it. But I spared the king, ready to sacrifice the people. They spared the best of the animals. Okay, so that's a problem. The people did that. But I did the king to make a sacrifice to God. Now, because, you see, obviously, God, you weren't looking at everything here. You said destroy everything, but you weren't looking close enough because this one was good. That one was bad, but this one was good. And actually, this one's good to make me look good with you. And besides that, if I'm really honest, this one's good not to make me look good with you, but it's good to make me look good with these people because they think I'm doing it to make you good. Okay, now we say, well, I'm glad that God got saved and he's not the Old Testament God anymore. Whoa. But he's told me a lot of things in life that don't make sense that require me just to trust. And if I measure it by my human love and my human empathy, I'm going to come up short. But you see, God doesn't love. He is love. So everything he does is love. And everything he does has a redemptive purpose.
Oh, come on.
Okay, we won't go any farther in that. But. So, empowered for our commitments is love, and then that leads to that place of doing actions or faith toward God, and then responses. When we know someone loves us, we do works that speak of faith toward them, and then when they give something to us, we respond to them. We respond saying, we don't respond to get or to get some blessing to who we are. We respond to say we want all of who you are because we appreciate all of who you are. We don't respond to them so they'll appreciate who we are. We respond to them so that we can tell them how much we appreciate all of who they are, not just a little bit that they are. We respond to God. That's a tithe level relationship. We respond to God with a judgment of love. We give something, not because we want him to bless what we still have, not because we want him to appreciate the fact that we gave something to him. No, we're telling him, whoa, that's just a little of you. We want all of you. I do that with my wife. Babe, I want all of you. Okay, how about one another in the community? If I respond to you, I'm saying, whoa, there's more there. Come on, there's more there. I'm not responding so that you'll appreciate I responded to you. I'm not responding to my wife so that she'll appreciate that I responded to her. I'm responding to her because I appreciate her. I'm responding to God because I appreciate him. I respond to friendship because I appreciate them, not because I want them to appreciate me. Okay, I'm describing life-giving relationships. And then last night we went into a fourth one, which was that one on submission. And man, I had some interesting dreams last night. Anyway, anytime you get into this one. But you see, authority is never control. And so we looked at the curse of the fall. Let's look there again in Revelation or in Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. We'll go to verse 17. But last night we looked at verse 16. The previous night we looked at the couple verses before that. There are actually seven things that God spoke at the fall of man when they chose the knowledge of good and evil. When human beings, Adam and Eve, chose the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it set up an administration for humanity that was based on information, a knowledge of good and a knowledge of evil, so that you can then assess the information, and you can make good decisions, do good things, and be a good person. But the problem with that is, when you are informed, everybody has a different assessment of the information.
Oh, come on.
And so your assessment of the information can redefine good. And so you think you're doing good, but you're really doing bad. And it's on 20 points down the list before you realize the title of the list was How to Do Bad. How to destroy somebody. How to destroy you. At first it looked at how to have a relationship. But the title really said how to get a relationship. Relationship is not something you get. Relationship is something you give. And then you reap what you sow. Ooh, I should say that again.
Yes.
Relationship is not something you get. It's something you give. And then you reap what you sow. Jesus gave relationship first. And then he reaped what he sowed. He loved us when we didn't love him. And he gave his entire life without any solid evidence that we would give anything to him. And he reaped what he sowed. He reaped the nations responding back after his resurrection to him. So yes, I believe he gave it all. And he would have given it all if no one would have responded.
Come on.
But because he gave it all, everyone can respond. We think, I'm going to give relationship if you respond. But what if they don't respond? If that affects my giving of relationship, then my relationship is a taking relationship, not a giving relationship. Now, when I say these things, we all have mixtures of this. No shame on you. It's simply saying, whoa, whoops, wow, I really do need you, God. Okay, I'm 44 years old in Christ, and I'm way more the giver now than I was 44 years ago. My goodness, I'm way more the giver than I was in the 1980s. I used to be called the prophet whose nose would cut diamonds. That's what they called me. My reputation was I was the prophet whose nose would cut diamonds. Everything was right or wrong, and I knew how to tell it. I was Mr. Prophetic Death. And God wrecked me. You know one of the simplest things he did? We had a restaurant in our town. You'll love this. How many of you like things right? You like things right? Nice and straight. We had a restaurant in our town called the Shrimp Shack. And it was built in a part of our town that was sinking because it was built on landfill. And you couldn't close any of the doors. They were all crooked. The windows were all crooked. The pictures were all crooked. Tables all crooked. Chairs all crooked. And God would tell me, I'd be sitting in my office as a pastor, and he'd say, go have lunch at the Shrimp Shack. And I'd say, well, who do I take? He said, just go have lunch at the Shrimp Shack. And I'd say, oh, God, everything is crooked. He said, yeah, but they got really good food there. And I sat in a crooked restaurant until I learned that that crooked restaurant was beautiful. That was awesome.
How long did it take?
Okay. I had a prophetic word spoken over me in a prophetic conference. They called me out, 450 people, me, my wife, and my family. And the guy said, says the Spirit of God, some would say I've been hard on you, but I've given you a forehead like Ezekiel. And in the same way that you yield the sword on these, pointing to my family, you will yield the sword on my people. And he gave this word, da 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 da. And then at the end of the word, my pastor, I was associate pastor, my senior pastor stopped it and said, that word was not God. So they handed me a cassette tape, said, do you have a tape player in your car? I said, yes, sir. Go listen to this and make a judgment. Okay, the first part of it says, yay, some would say I've been hard with you, son. So thanks a lot. My senior pastor just stopped the whole flipping meeting, said it's not God. Now I have to decide, is it God or not? Forehead like Ezekiel. Well, that was quick. But in the prophecy, it was God, and I discerned it was God. There was one place where he had checked it. But anyway, my point is this. There was a line in there in the same way that you yield the sword. And so I had some good scribers in the church. And of course, they scribed that prophetic word for me, doing a good job. And they changed the word yield to wield, because everybody knows you wield a sword. And that prophesier, that prophet just didn't know what he was saying. He got slipped up on words. So in the same way you wield the sword on these will be the way you wield the sword on my people. And I have come to find out that God was not saying wield the sword. He was saying the same way you yield the sword on your family will be the same way you do not use the sword on the church.
Oh, come on.
In the same way you quit being Mr. Hard Nose, Diamond Nose. Now, as a father, I wasn't Diamond Nose. But then I realized, what's the difference between being a prophet and being a daddy? I was already raising my kids to hear God, not to know right and wrong, but to know the voice. And then I realized, why am I that way as a dad? And I'm that different in the church? So I let God wreck me. And now I think I'm known as the weeping prophet. I'm not the nose sharp nose diamond. I just get I'm soft. Okay. So back to the curses of futility. Seven things spoken. The first one was wherever there's a dry place, there has to be a serpent. Serpent crawls on his belly in the dust. So wherever there's a dead place in your heart, there's going to be a deceiver, conflicter, and a devourer. So when my wife and I, if one of us starts getting deceived and we start getting into arguments and we try to kill each other, let's say that happens. I want to argue with her, and I want to say things that kill her. She does not have a problem. I have a problem. Because the problem is there's a dry place in me. Something in my heart is dead to her. So I got to get a revelation of love. Because love turns a desert into a watered garden. And now the serpent can't live there anymore. Okay. No one can make me argue. No one can make me frustrated. No one. If they can, they can't. No human can make me frustrated. Only I can get frustrated if their attempts and their weapons can activate frustration in me. The kingdom of God is inside of me. You can't take that away from me. I just got to learn how to yield to it and grow in it. Yeah? So when you have those moments, lighten up. Get a revelation of love. You were born to be loved. Get a revelation of love. Now that you have that, get a revelation. That person also was born to be loved. They weren't born to be right. Okay, then the words that were spoken over the woman, we looked at the three things that were spoken over the woman. The first was, in pregnancy, there'll be great worrisomeness and great pain in childbirth. So wherever something's going to be birthed, it's suffering, a temptation to fear death. I'm not sure I want this situation. Am I willing to go through this? Do I really want this? It often in the world, it leads to abortion. In the church, it just leads to, forget this place. I want out of here. Okay? The whole mentality of wanting to, you know, listen, if Jesus were to come back right now and say, this is it, we're going home, I hope I'm mature enough to argue with him. I'm serious. I hope I'm mature enough to argue with him, and I hope I'm tender enough to argue with him to say, no, can't be, look, there's still more. I don't want to get out of here and leave the world going to hell in a handbag. I want to be here until I bring heaven into every corner of hell.
Yeah. Amen.
As long as I have breath in me, I want to bring the breath of heaven into my world. I don't know what you're going to do with your world, but my world's going to be full of life. And the rooms that I walk in are going to feel better when I leave them. The earth's going to be a better place because I was here. Okay, I'm not speaking that. I'm speaking that boasting in the Lord. And you too. Come on. So, I'm not afraid of death. So I have works that speak of faith. I, I, relationships. I'm not going to fear losing my comfort zone or losing my convenience. I'm willing to make a sacrifice of faith towards you. Okay, we looked at that. Second thing on the woman was a wife's desire will be for her husband. That's a curse. In spite of the fact that many women think that's a blessing, or guys think, "Ooh, I got a woman that thinks her desire is for me." Okay, all human beings, their desire is for God, not for another human being. Therefore, their personal testimony doesn't come from a human being. Their personal testimony comes from God. And when we respond to human beings, we're activating that testimony that comes from God to them. We're bringing all of God's testimony in them. And we're responding to God, bringing all of God's testimony into us. Relationships. Okay, so our commitment is a revelation of love. Because I love, now I do actions that speak of my faith. I'm not afraid to sacrifice. I'm not afraid to die. I'll give up my life for your sake because I love you. And now when I recognize who you are and you're not under me, I'm not the fulfillment of your desire. You're not the fulfillment of my desire. God's the fulfillment of who we are. But when God gives a little of himself to me, I give a little of myself to him so that I can tell him, I want all of you. When my wife gives a little of herself to me, I don't give a little of myself to her so that she'll appreciate myself. I give a little of myself to her, telling her, I want all of you. I appreciate all of you. When I give my little of myself to my friends, my friends give a little of their self to me, I give a little of myself to them. Not because I want them to appreciate all of myself, but I'm saying I want all of you. That's a life-giving relationship. And then in submission, the third thing on the woman was the husband will rule over the wife. That's a curse. Okay? Because the husband and the wife are to rule together, co-heirs, side by side. A man is not, he's the head. That doesn't mean he's over her. In control, it means he's responsible to bring her alongside of him in everything. We looked at that last night. It's in Ephesians. Present her to himself. Bring her alongside of himself. Jesus is bringing the church alongside of himself on a throne where we rule and reign with him. Okay. Now, the first thing on the man, let's look at that, verse 17. To Adam, he said, because you've heeded the voice of your wife. Now, he doesn't say, Adam, because you listen to women, and you should never listen to women because they're less than men. He would say, because you listen to the voice of the deception that your wife was speaking. Because God speaks through my wife a lot. And if I don't listen to God through my wife, I'm an idiot. If I don't listen to God through my grandkids, I'm an idiot. If my dog says something, I don't even have a dog. That's a miracle, but it could happen. Uh-oh. Okay. Okay. So, because you heeded the voice of your wife, in other words, you didn't listen to God, you listened to a human voice. And you've eaten from the tree of which I've commanded you, saying, you shall not eat. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles that it shall bring to you. Now, that means the ground, this sign is on men, but it affects men, women, cultures, societies, relationships. And it especially affects men. It means I can't be awake to the relationship because too many things are pricking my flesh and requiring my attention. Work was too hard today. You don't expect me to listen to you now, do you, honey? I would listen to you, but you decided to share your heart right at the beginning of the football game. And besides that, I haven't gotten everything done that needs to be done today. And then we get this one. The wife comes and tells the husband something. She says, there's this, 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 and this. And if you're not a smart man, you think she's telling you she wants you to do a bunch of things. Let me give you a little secret. When she says, there's this, 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 and this, she doesn't want you to fix this, 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 and this. She wants you to hear her. And she wants you to feel it. And then maybe grab one of those things and do something. But before you do anything, she wants you to hear the story and she wants you to feel her heart. She wants you to listen. She doesn't want you to fix it. But because you're a man, you think fix it. You're too used to thorns and thistles. And she's not a thorn and a thistle. She's soft, fuzzy, and wonderful. And she's trying to share her heart with you.
All right. Now we're talking. Come on. I like it.
And until you learn to listen, you don't have any ability to fix anything.
Amen.
And actually, you should be fixing things before she has to tell you things to be fixed. But you shouldn't be fixing things so much you never spend time listening to her. You were formed from dirt. She was formed from your rib. She came from your heart. You came from the soil. So you can't understand this heart thing. But she came out of you, sir. So she's the missing link. She's the other half you lost. So you better listen to the half that got disconnected so that it can be reconnected. Okay? Now, I'll just drop a little deal. Leaders, pastors, you lead a congregation. Okay, leadership is a masculine role, but you got to be a good wife before you can be a good husband. So if you're going to be a good husband, you got to be a good wife. You got to be activated, facilitated, and released by God. Receive, respond, and be released. Then to be a good husband, you got to be a good activator, facilitator, and releaser. Okay, now, a good principle for leaders to learn is you got to lead, but also listen to the bride. Don't listen to do everything she wants, but listen to hear her heart. She needs to express her heart, all right? Did you get into that?
Come on.
Okay, so now, the curse of futility then. Now, this relates to also, we've been talking about in the wilderness, in the promised land, when they went in the promised land, there was these ites. These ites represent these curses of futility, and they resist the grace of Holy Spirit that gives us life-giving relationships. So the Canaanite represent a self-seeker. My own needs met illegitimately because I got dead places. I need to meet it. Greed. So I have to get a revelation of love to overcome the Canaanite. The Hittite, fear. I got to get a revelation of love to have faith towards you and not be afraid to die to destroy the Hittite. The Amorite, bitterness. I can't respond to bitterness. I got to respond to who I know you are, not a bitterness. I can't be submerged in bitterness. I got to be submerged in life. So I respond to life. I destroy that Amorite spirit. And then we talked about the parasite, superficially individualistic. Instead of being connected in relationship of submission, I want to be independent. I'm disconnected. Okay, I'm not under in relationship. But then there's one that we come to now, and it is, I've got to find my list. Okay, after this is the Hivite. And the word Hivite means wicked. But wickedness means to be disconnected. Wicked, disconnected. Now, the curse of futility is from now on, the earth is going to be futile. It's going to be filled with thorns and thistles. It's a dead place. It's a place that gets your attention so much you can't be awake to God. You can't care about the things of relationship because you're too busy responding to the things that prick your flesh. You're too busy responding to circumstances. So in essence, you're disconnected from relationship because there's too many thorns and thistles in the desert to deal with. So you're not awake. You're apathetic. I don't care anymore. I got too many things to care for. I got too many thorns and thistles to deal with. I can't care about you anymore. I'm a little apathetic today. I'm an apathetic person towards you. I'm apathetic toward the relationship. There's too many thorns and thistles to deal with. There's too many problems to solve. I got too many things to do. You can't expect me to be intimate and responsible, can you? So what ends up happening is I become disconnected from relationship. That's called wickedness. With God, if I'm not alive to God, watch and pray. The spirit is willing. The flesh is indeed weak. I used to hear all kinds of sermons on how weak the flesh is, but Jesus wasn't talking to the boys about how weak the flesh is. He was saying, wake up. The spirit's really willing right now. The spirit of might, resurrection life, is the antidote to this part. I got to have a supernatural awareness and awakeness to the relationship so that nothing in life can prick my flesh and get attention of who I am more than this relationship. My wife, I got to be awake to her so much. After 40 years, I'm so alive to her. No thorn, no thistle can get my attention that robs me of who she is and my love for her. I'm awake to her. In the history of God's people, after the kingdom became divided, they became apathetic. They became not caring about God. And the prophets came, wake up, wake up, wake up. And they didn't wake up. They ended up getting scattered. They ended up going into captivity. They ended up going 70 years in a sleep bed. Four guys stayed awake. Four guys stayed awake. They went through a surgical operation and made it so they couldn't have kids. Maybe that's why they were awake. No, they lost everything. Okay. So, relationships that are life-giving relationships don't get distracted by the thorns and the thistles. They don't get disconnected. Now, how would you ever even get disconnected? Okay, you have relationships. If someone is watching this, tuning into this, you have a relationship. It starts out first with a revelation of love. Your relationship with God begins with a revelation of love. He loves me. It isn't a revelation that you love him. It's a revelation he loves you. That's what empowers you now to love him. And it's supernatural. I love you. He picked me. He chose me. Okay, when you get married, your heart goes big. Your head goes stupid and your heart goes big. It's supposed to. That's the way it works. Heart goes big, head goes stupid. So you're supposed to know where to let your heart go before your head goes down. Because when your heart goes somewhere, you can't get through to somebody through their head. Because the head is stupid. And it's supposed to be that way. So you're supposed to know where to put your heart. And when you know where your heart can go, then you can put your heart there. Guess what? You can put your heart toward loving God. You ready? You can do that. Hey, you can put all your heart toward loving God. Okay? If you put your heart toward loving what God does more than you put your heart toward loving God, you're going to get in trouble. If you put your heart toward being healed more than you put your heart toward loving God, you're going to get in trouble. Yep. If you put your heart toward your wife or your husband being what you need them to be more than you put your heart toward loving them, you're going to get in trouble. If you were somebody who's not married and you're looking for your spouse and you find somebody who hasn't encountered God and they don't love God and God says, this is your future, this is your husband, here's what you say. Okay, Dad, that might be fine, but you're going to have to make him a son first. It's not even raw material right now. So you come talk to me again later, Dad, after you fix it. Because if you go for that person and they don't love God, you are already setting yourself up for trouble. Yep. But once your heart goes there, your head goes stupid, and nobody's going to talk you out of it. Yeah. Now, when two people who don't know God come together, that very often works out. But when one person loves God and the other one doesn't, and they come together, it almost never works out. It can, but it almost never works out. So you got to know where your heart can go. Okay? So in a life-giving relationship, you can put your heart to love. And when you know somebody loves you, do works that speak of that love. Live from your heart. Always live in the first love. Now, if you don't know somebody loves you, the earth is going to shake. You're going to get offended, right? Which means earthquake, offense. So the best thing to do is never take an offense. But let's say by some rare, very seldom happened incident that you may have an offense in your life with God or with a human being. It's very rare. It's like on the airlines. In the event of an emergency, these things will fall from the ceiling. Well, I got news for you. It's a little more frequent with offenses than it is with drop-down air supply. Okay, so in case you are a bit offended, then what that does is that leads you into a second territory. In that second territory, what you start doing is judging things, not by love, but you judge it by natural sight. And it can be true or not true. Well, they said something bad to me today. And the truth is, they did say something bad. But you loving them is not dependent on them saying something good to you. And so they might have forgotten who they are, so you need to remember who they are. So don't take an offense, then you won't make a judgment according to the flesh, according to natural understanding. And you speak evil of them, you make a judgment. Now, once you make a judgment, now you've moved into an area, you've got an offense that's led to a judgment. You've got to let that judgment go before you can get free from this offense. Okay, but then it moves into a third area, and the third area is you don't respond to them anymore like you used to respond. Matter of fact, you got bitterness. And so instead of responding to them, your moon turns blood. Your moon is no longer a light responder. It's a flesh responder. The life of the flesh goes out and the moon turns blood. And so you get defiled. You begin to see yourself not as a responder, but you see yourself as someone who doesn't need to respond, because now you're moving toward the direction of divorce. You're moving toward the direction of destruction of the relationship. With God, you get offended with God, you make a judgment of God according to the natural. Here's the natural. You were supposed to answer at 8 o'clock this morning, and you didn't answer until 11:59, 5 years later. And that is a fact. I wrote it down in my journal. You were supposed to answer at 8 o'clock that morning, but it was 11:59, 5 years later that you answered. Right? That's a judgment. Okay? I mean, why did you make that judgment? Because you got offended with God when he didn't answer the way you thought he should answer. Come on. Okay? So if you're there, if anybody's there, if that's all the far... when you make the judgment, now you get defiled. Now you begin to separate. You don't respond to him quite the way you used to. Okay? In the practical, we can say this. Tithe is just a shadow, just an expression of this, like financial tithe. You don't tithe or you move where you sit. That can be a sign of that. But what about you don't respond in your relationship like you used to? You used to sit together on the couch, but now you got your chair, I got my chair. And then you start getting, you're defiled. And then that moves into an area where we said last night, the sun, the stars fall and they drop like figs in the late season. The stars fall. And stars are lights. So in relationship, submission one to another. A life-giving relationship loves one another, does works that speak of that love. They respond to one another and then they submit to one another. They're in relationship with one another. They're in the dance of life and they're bringing life. Okay, but if they get to the point where they've been defiled, then pretty soon what happens is they don't submit to one another. They become insubordinate. Okay, so stars drop. Can't find your way by them anymore. They don't make the proper animal shapes. We don't know how to find our way home. Okay, so there's a disconnection, not responding. Okay, And so then the next level is the sky rolls up like a scroll. You can find these in Revelation 6, like verse 12, 13, right in there. In the decreation, opening of the sixth seal. The fifth thing that happens is the sky rolls up like a scroll. Okay, now, the curse of the fall is the ground is cursed for your sake. Thorns and thistles, you'll reap its harvest. You have to deal with these thorns and thistles. In other words, you're in a dead world, a wilderness, that only gets your attention when it pricks your flesh. So you're too busy with earthly things to be focused on heavenly possibilities. And the only thing that cures this level is resurrection from the dead. Spirit of might. Resurrection from the dead. This relates to the fifth letter in Revelation, which is called the Church of Sardis. And Sardis means Prince of Joy. And their problem is they're dead. But if they weren't dead, God says that he's going to clothe them in white, and he's going to confess them before angels and before the Father. He's going to say, you're alive, you're awake, you're sent, you're being sent, you're alive, you're awake. Everything in your life is about heaven. But if you're not alive and awake, in the presence of the Lord is the fullness of joy. Sardis, Prince of Joy. But if you're not alive and awake, you lose joy. There ain't no joy. Okay, when you're in the desert being pricked by thorns and thistles, you've lost your joy. Okay, if you're in a relationship where you got offended, you made a judgment, you got defiled, you're insubordinate, now you don't care anymore. You're at a point right now, you are believing the thorns and the thistles in your relationship more than a heavenly scroll. And so heavenly scroll is being rolled up for you. And what you need is resurrection from the dead. You need the spirit of might to give you back your heavenly testimony, your heavenly destiny called a relationship. Because one is the loneliest number. Okay, now, if you're a single individual, you're not one because you got God. So get your relationship there. Okay? It's not a less thing to be single than it is to be married. It doesn't make you less of a person. It just gives you different challenges. All right? Okay? And it's a good thing to find a relationship, but if you don't find relationship as a single person with God, and if you don't find these life-giving things now as a single person, you'll bring relational problems into your marriage. If you've been part of relationships with people in 50 different churches, and now you're not in relationship, okay? Now you can't be in relationship with, to be honest, you can't be in relationship with hundreds of people. You can be friendly to hundreds of people, but you can't be in relationship with hundreds of people. Jesus was in relationship with 12, and he's like Superman. So you got to find where are those connections in life that you're in relationship with. Now, it should be local expression. There should be local expression of that. But too many times we try to hold relationships by structure. We try to hold relationships by law. And structure and law doesn't create relationships. Relationships require structure, but structure doesn't create relationships. You know, if you didn't have a house and you ended up having a family, you would need to create a house for your family. But the house wouldn't give you a family. The family would require a house. Too many times we think the house gives us a family. No, the family requires a house. But the house doesn't give you a family. Your structure doesn't give you a family. Your relationships give you a family. Now, figure this one out. You don't pick your brothers and your sisters. They're born. And then in the family of God, you find some that you relate to. Give your life to those you relate to. I tried to say a statement one of these nights, last night or the night before, and I didn't finish it. I got up today, I thought, I never finished that thought. But the thought was this: a wise pastor told me one time, quit loving the people you love and love the people that love you. He told me that as a pastor, and it saved my life as a pastor. So if a pastor's watching this, I would say, as someone who's been a pastor, as a senior pastor for 20 years, and someone who deals with pastors all the time, I would say, pastor, quit loving the people you love and love the people who love you. And now I say to all the members of the church, quit loving the people you love and love the people that love you. And what will happen is you'll be able to love everyone. Because when you love the people you love and they don't love you, they take your love. Now, I'm not contradicting what I said earlier. We got to love even when people don't love. But when we build relationships, okay, so even in a broken relationship, broken family, you love, you give love, okay? But don't become the Holy Spirit. Don't become responsible for where they're not being responsible to the point that it robs you of being alive. And then you can give love. Okay. Now, when relationships are healthy, it's easy. When they're not so healthy, it's not so easy. Okay, so what do we got to do to have a life-giving relationship? If you are in a place right now where things become more important than relationship, this fifth one is, you're not watching, we're not awake. Prickly things have our attention. So our expectations for the relationship are exceeded by our expectations of problems.
What was that?
Our expectations for the relationship are exceeded, overtaken by our expectations for the problems. All these thorns, all these thistles, all these thorns, all these thistles. And matter of fact, I even end up looking to find satisfaction in things, and things become more important than the relationship. And I even begin to say, well, if you would do this, then I could. But the truth is, you probably couldn't. And almost never do relationships at this level get healed when they're broken to this degree. But they can, but it's only by God. And God can do all things.
Come on.
And you got to get back to that place of first love. So you could easily say this: God, wow, I don't know how I got here. Okay, I'm going to share a story as a pastor. I was on the front of my church one day, and we were worshiping on a Sunday morning, and it sucked. And I thought, if I were to invite somebody to church, would I invite them to this church? And I thought, no, I wouldn't invite them here. And then I thought, this is my church. I'm responsible. And I knew it needed a miracle. I thought, and the real issue was this: this place is not fun at all. You know, not everything has to be fun. But at some point, there's got to be some fun.
Come on.
I'm smart enough to know life is life and death is death. And so at that point, God started messing with me. And I shared a story earlier. I've never really liked the King James Version. I use a new King James, but the King James, the these and the thous have never done too much for me. And I never really quite got it when people prophesy and it changes to King James. And I've never really quite got that when they preach, it changes to King James. When they talk in everyday world, it like sounds like a normal person. And then when they speak, it sounds like different. That always bugged me. So one day, God spoke to me in King James because he knows it bugs me. And he was making a point. And the point was this. He said, thus saith God. That's what he said. He said, thus saith God, lighten up. And it was at that season when I stood in the front of the church and I thought, if I were to invite somebody to this church, I wouldn't invite them. I don't like this church. And then I realized, I'm the problem. So, if you're in a marriage and it isn't life anymore, thus saith God, lighten up.
All right.
And then he said this. He said, you think too much. He said, you're thinking about things I haven't thought about in years. Now, some people may even measure me by that statement to say, well, God would never say something like that. Fine. Have a God that doesn't say that kind of stuff. My friend knows how to get my attention. And so I did. I put on my phone, ho, thus saith God, lighten up. But every time I turned my phone on, it would go, oh, thus saith God, lighten up. And man, over the next few years, I got to be the most lightened up pastor I ever met in my life. And I got to tell you, church became really fun.
Oh, right.
It still had problems, but you know what? I like it. When I transitioned it to my son, it was my favorite church on planet Earth. My son's been my pastor for the last 7 years. My favorite church on planet Earth. Now, I can say, you're my favorite. You're my favorite. Maybe favorites come in pieces. Okay, but it is my favorite. Okay, so in relationships, it's got to be life. We got to be awake. We got to be alive to God. And so that means something supernatural from heaven. Don't let heaven's scroll roll up. Don't let heaven roll up like a scroll. Don't let what the future promises you roll up like a scroll. So you got to get back to your first love. So lighten up and then choose to believe, not to submit to your relationship as the Lord, but as unto the Lord. Practice reconnecting to God. Practice reconnecting to your community. Practice reconnecting in submission as unto the Lord. Okay? And then dare to respond with a belief that you're not responding to that person. You're responding to the fullness of what God has for that person. And you're not responding. Practice responding to appreciate them. And when you see something that is wrong, or you see something that you think is wrong, practice being stupid. And God gave you a gift for that. He did. And if that's too complicated, oh! Quit using your brain and start using your spirit. You don't hear God with your soul. You hear God with your spirit, and then it floods your soul.
Amen.
And when your soul is damaged, the last thing you need to do is depend on a damaged soul.
Yes.
So you need to let your spirit flood your soul. Let God's spirit flood your spirit, and then flood your soul. And then get back to that place of first love, where you can say to God, "Hi, here I am." And if you, in your relationship, your marriage, get back to that place. "Hi, here I am. I'm here. I'm going to live in my first love. This is the first day of the rest of our life." Or in your relationship with your friend, "Here I am. This is the first day of the rest of our life." My covenant friends, my apostolic friends, four friends, five of us all together, we've got an agreement. We say we never leave the table. We stay connected. We've talked about the day we die. We talked about what that looks like. And I remember sitting. I don't know if I told you the whole story about the three cats, but we were sitting at the Three Cats restaurant in Barcelona, Spain. And the bread and the cheese. I didn't tell you all of it, did I? Okay. We're sitting there with our friends. We talked about the day we die. I told you that. But here's what else we did. We're sitting there. Okay, now see if you can handle this. These are my friends, my covenant friends. I grab a piece of cheese and it's sheep cheese. Oh, I love sheep cheese. And I smell it. Make a mistake. Don't ever smell sheep cheese. So I make a comment about the cheese. It smells like something. And I used a little bit of a coarse word. I said, "It smells like something."
Okay, we know.
Yeah. Poo-poo, manure. But actually, I said it smells like a monkey stuck his finger up his butt. That's what I said. It was a stupid saying. So now, don't judge me for that saying. You said stuff like that. Okay, but my friend John looks at me, and he just looks at me. He said, "How would you know?" And the point was real. How would I know? And in the midst of this lightness, I want to tell you the faithfulness of my friend God. You would almost think, well, God isn't even going to be in that room, is he? And my friend David, we're sitting there. And at the table, we got all our food. We're sitting on the sidewalk out in front of in the busy area of Barcelona, Spain. And he grabs a piece of bread and he says, "Oh, on the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took bread." And the presence of God falls on all five of us. And we start weeping right out there on the street. And we eat dinner together. And we have an agreement. We promise until the day we die, we'll never leave the table. We can disagree, and we often do. We can express different opinions, and we almost always do. But we can never leave the table. It's okay to be different.
Come on.
But it's not okay to be apart. Got it?
Good.
Okay, so God help us with life-giving relationships. And help us always stay in the simplest place. The place of our first love. So that we can have lots of first experiences. Lord, would you let that happen here in the Kootenays? Would you let every congregation, every church, every pastor, every marriage, every man and every woman discover that place of first love? The place of saying to you and to one another, "Here I am." And then would you allow would you cause the community of God here to be like Isaiah chapter 11? Where it looks like Star Wars bar. Enemies, former enemies, are all at the table together. Bears are next to goats. Lions are next to sheep. Cobras are next to little kids. And everybody's experience in the life that comes by the sevenfold grace of heaven. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Come on, Jesus. Good job.